The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 96. Xiaozhou's three turning words, main case. Xiaozhou offered three turning words to his community. A gold Buddha does not pass through a furnace. A wood Buddha does not pass through a fire. A mud Buddha does not pass through water. With each of these turning words, there's a verse. So the way it's handled is that each of those is taken up as its own case. So that's what I'm going to do in three separate talks. And Suedo offered three different poems, verses for each. And so this is, I'm going to deal with the mud Buddha today. A mud Buddha does not pass through water. Spiritual light illumines heaven and earth. Standing in the snow, if he didn't rest, who would not carve an imitation? And this is an interesting koan because it seems like each of these is pretty similar, other than mud, wood, and gold. But the single footnote, and notice there's also no introduction, so it's very sort of to the point. And the only footnote says, what did he say? The three parts are not the same. So for the student working with this, how are they different? And why does Suedo offer three separate verses for each? Xiaozhou, most many of you are familiar with on some level, sort of stands out as one of the great teachers of Chan, Chinese Zen, Chinese Buddhism, and in part because he lived a very long time. He lived to be 120. And he came to the Dharma young. So he was quite young when he came to realization, then studied for a long, long time, kind of for the rest of his life, which is really what every good practitioner should do. And there are many, there's a recorded teachings of Xiaozhou, so a lot of these teachers, there isn't much left about them, or of their teachings, but with Xiaozhou, there's a collection of writings, of teachings, and a bit that's known about his life. He was studied before he came to study with Nanchuan, who was his primary teacher. And when he first came to Nanchuan, he had already been studying with another teacher. And it said that where he learned to be courteous, which I take to mean that he'd been well trained as a monk. And so when he came to see Nanchuan for the first time, Nanchuan was laying down. And in seeing Xiaozhou, he said, "Where have you come from?" And Xiaozhou said, "I came from the temple of the Standing Buddha," which was the name of a temple that had a famous Standing Buddha. And Nanchuan said, "Then did you see the Standing Buddha there?" And Xiaozhou said, "I don't see a standing image. I see a reclining Buddha." And Nanchuan said, "Are you a student with a master or a student without a master?" And Xiaozhou said, "A student with a master." And Xiaozhou said, "Where is your master?" And Xiaozhou said, "In spite of the intense cold of early spring, I hope that your honorable body is doing well." And then it said, Nanchuan called out to the head monk and says, "Give this monk a special place." I mean, kind of extraordinary. Very simple, but something very special about that introduction. He went on to study with Nanchuan for a long time, decades, and continued to live and teach at that monastery after Nanchuan died. And then he went on a pilgrimage and eventually ended up in the town of Chaozhou, from which he took his name. And part of the reason for his place, I think within the Zen tradition, you know, with the stories, the histories that within the Buddhist tradition, in a sense, whether they're factual or not, are told for particular reasons. You know, it's not just to entertain us. They're teaching. They're used as teaching points. And with Xiaozhou, you know, what is sort of stands out is both his dedication to the Dharma, that he really was a student for his whole life. It's said that he said that he would teach anyone, no matter how young, if they asked and were keen to study the Dharma, and he would learn from anyone, no matter how old they might be, or how young they might be, for that matter, if they had something to teach. So he embodies that sense of a real person of the way, somebody who's really got that mind that is continues to be hungry and yearning towards the Dharma, and that he continued his practice and his life in the Dharma for all of those many, many decades. And so in that way, he kind of presents us with an example of a journey, a spiritual journey, a life lived within the Dharma. You know, we're so conditioned to think of things in terms of, you know, a process to a goal. You know, we go to school to get a degree, we do this to get that. Everything has a beginning and an end, and it's, you know, it can be difficult, challenging to sort of think about a practice, particularly in the beginning when it can be difficult and challenging, to think of a practice that for each of us, maybe we can point to some beginning, but it has no end. As far as the Dharma is concerned, there's no end. Even if a person finishes formal training, that's just formal training. Their Dharma path, their study, their first and foremost being a student of the Dharma, that continues. Hopefully all the way through to our death, through our death itself. And so it holds up this sort of vision of something that, I mean, it's not entirely unknown. People who are artists, musicians, people who have a relationship with something that is such a vital part of their life that they, you know, think that they intend to continue all through their life. But with a spiritual journey, because it's, you know, it's a path to enlightenment. We think, well, okay, well, it's a path to enlightenment. So at some point we get enlightened and then it's done, right? The path reaches its natural conclusion. And whether we come to enlightenment or not, the path has no conclusion. And that in and of itself is telling us something about the nature of the Dharma, the nature of the path itself, the nature of, ultimately, us. And that sense of path, which is so important in Buddhism, that the Buddha laid out from the very beginning, you know, he laid out that life is dukkha, that everything we experience has the potential to create suffering and unhappiness. And that needs to be understood, that arises because of our grasping, our clinging, that needs to be relinquished, that we can free ourselves from that cycle. That needs to be realized. And the path needs to be walked, traveled, engaged. And so it's very much a practice of engaging, of doing, right? We don't sit here all week and think about practice or talk about practice or debate practice or write poetry about practice or make movies about practice, although people have done all of those things. But for practitioners, it's practicing the Dharma. We might just sort of, that might seem self-evident, particularly once you become a practitioner, but to really reflect on what that means, to be a practitioner of something that really has no boundary. And the path can refer to the Eightfold Path, it can refer to the three trainings of morality and concentration or samadhi and prajna, realization, wisdom. It's said that in the sort of, you know, endless sort of universal view of Buddhism, which has no beginning, that the Buddha Shakyamuni was just the Buddha of his time, of our time. And that in every eon, there is a Buddha, and an eon is a very, very long time, in which somebody sets out on the path, alone, by themselves, comes to enlightenment, and then teaches. And part of that cycle is that they come to realization and they teach the Four Noble Truths. And they teach the Eightfold Path. So that each time a Buddha comes into the world, they recognize the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path as the essential, sort of the foundational teaching. And what's interesting is, and in the sutras, there are sutras where somebody, a student will ask the Buddha, the one I was just reading, the Buddha asked the question himself. He said, what's the difference between the Buddha, the Tathagata, and an enlightened practitioner? And he said, the difference is that the Buddha or Tathagata comes to enlightenment in a sense without any path given to them, without any teachings already laid out, without any guide. And that everybody who follows the Buddha comes to the same realization with a guide. And he says that's the only difference, is that a Buddha comes to realization studying with a Buddha, studying without a Buddha, and everybody else comes studying with one. So here, Zhao Zhou asks this question. A mud Buddha does not pass through water. And of course, right away, we see that he's presenting a difference in terms of what kind of Buddha is this, which might lead the student to wonder, well, what kind of Buddha am I? Well, what kind of Buddha do you want to be? Gold? Wood? Mud? Are they different? In the record of Zhao Zhou, where this is drawn from, Zhao Zhou entered the hall and gave a teaching saying, a metal Buddha can't pass through a furnace, a wood Buddha can't pass through a fire, and a mud Buddha can't pass through water. The true Buddha sits within. And then he goes on from there. And in the commentary, Wan Wu says, this phrase is exceedingly indulgent. The real Buddha sits within. He says that's exceedingly indulgent. So he doesn't even include it in the koan. Why? How is that indulgent? What is Buddha? Buddha means the awakened one. Bodhidharma said it means miraculous awareness. Miraculous awareness. Miraculous and yet available to everyone. It's not a miracle for the few. It's not a miracle that somehow exists only for the select. It's everybody's mind possesses this miraculous awareness. That's a different way of saying that we all have Buddha nature. And to realize the real nature of this awareness is to realize the nature of mind, to realize self-nature, It's what the Buddha and every teacher since the Buddha have said is ultimately our liberation. If we are entrapped within dukkha and samsara in our mind, then we have to be, can only be liberated in mind, within the mind, in a sense liberated to the mind. If enlightenment is to illuminate that which is has not been seen, is hidden or seems obscured, then enlightenment is to illuminate mind. And it's the mind that we already possess. And so when we come to this cushion and say, Shin, you don't bring some different mind with you. I mean, you couldn't, first of all, although you might like to. You work with the mind you have, which is not only fitting and necessary, but is actually perfect. It is the mind of our entanglement. It is the mind of our unentanglement, of our freedom. And the reason why your mind is perfect for you is because you and each of us have spent our lifetime cultivating this mind, in some ways knowingly, in many ways not knowing. And so it is rich or laden, depending on your mood, with all of your karma, all of your stuff, your house, the stuff of your house, which is universal and very particular, right? When you're experiencing something, the first sort of innate experience we have of that is that this is yours happening to you. Our first impulse is not, oh, this is a universal experience that happens to everybody, and I'm just having my moment. We see it in a very singular way, a very personal way, a very possessive kind of way. In other words, we identify with it. And because of that, it's presenting us with all of the storehouse of our entanglements, and because of that, it's personal, right? And so for somebody who cares, it matters to me, it matters to you, that that entanglement is personal because it's entangling you and you'd really like it not to. The mud Buddha does not pass through water. Passing through. This comes up in a lot of koans and a lot of sutras, coming and going. The Buddha said, all conditioned things are dukkha, the First Noble Truth. Condition meaning anything that comes into existence by virtue of dependently arising web of causation, which is another way of saying that it does not arise by itself, unto itself, alone, autonomously, independently. It is not a thing isolated, having its own being, its own power. And so the Buddha said all existence is condition, which means nothing arises by itself. There is no self-creating anything. From a Buddhist perspective, including God, and all things that arise in that state, which is everything, are dukkha, which means they possess the ability, when we encounter them, to cause us distress and dis-ease because they're impermanent. And we don't like that. So the Buddha is one who comes and goes thus, the Tathagata, free of a self being born and dying, free of something solid and fixed appearing. So think of a thought arising in your mind, or an emotion, better, because it's got a lot of something right? You feel it, right? It's in you. It's got affect. It sort of fills your the sensation of your body and mind, particularly if it's a powerful emotion. So it's definitely something. It's in the category of something, right? It's happening to you. So there's a sense of solidity there. It is something. It's happening to you. It wasn't there a moment ago. It just came. Where did it come from? Was it hiding? Just waiting for that moment when you weren't expecting it? And then when it passes, as it will, have you ever had anything that hasn't ultimately passed? Where does it go? Does it go back into hiding? To wait again? So there's a sense of something that must have a before, right? Because it came from somewhere. Wasn't there a moment before? Now it is. And it must go somewhere. But the Buddha said, all things are without coming and going. And so when Xiaozhou said, a mud Buddha does not pass through water from where? Going to where? Buddhism employs that sense, right? Prajnaparamita, crossing over to the other shore. We're on a path, right? Traveling up along a path. There's movement. We move forward. Very much conveying the sense of going, having come from. So Buddhism, the teachings themselves employ that. And so why does a mud Buddha not pass through water? So Zuido versifies this by saying a mud Buddha does not pass through water. Footnote says, it's soaked till the nose decomposes. Without wind, Xiaozhou raises waves. Which kind of started with the Buddha. You know, it's like as soon as he began talking about dukkha, it was like, oh, dukkha. Right? Suddenly it's like, it seems to be there. And so Xiaozhou, in a sense, the sense teachers create trouble by calling attention, naming, pointing. But they don't really create trouble, they're just pointing to the trouble that's already there. A mud Buddha does not pass through water. Spiritual light illumines heaven and earth. Standing in the snow, if he didn't rest, who would not carve an imitation? So here he's invoking the story of Hwekka, this second ancestor of Bodhidharma, which I talked about recently, so I won't go into it in too much detail, but whose name was Spiritual Light. So he's invoking Spiritual Light. Standing in the snow if he didn't rest. So Hwekka was a practitioner, came to Bodhidharma when Bodhidharma had come to China and gone to see Emperor Wu and then went to Shaolin and sat in a cave. I mean, this is the story that comes down to us, right? Which is filled with intentions for why that story is presented and has been passed down in terms of what it's teaching. And in particular, this encounter with Hwekka. So Hwekka comes, it's December, it's cold, and he asks for the teaching. And Bodhidharma is doing zazen, and he ignores him. And so Hwekka stands and waits to be acknowledged, right? Which is the appropriate thing to do. He doesn't just barge in, hey, I came all this way, right? He is seeking, he is asking. The teacher doesn't appear to be ready. Or perhaps the teacher is beginning to teach. And so Hwekka stands and waits and waits and waits, and it gets colder, and it's nighttime, and it starts snowing, and he stands in the snow, and it starts rising up above his knees. And eventually Bodhidharma turns to him and says, what are you doing standing there? And he says, I've come to seek the teachings. Please teach me. And Bodhidharma says, this wondrous path of the Buddhas requires zealous work over eons, practicing that which is difficult to practice, enduring what is hard to endure, with little virtue and petty knowledge, a shallow heart and an arrogant mind. How can you hope to find this Dharma? And so Weka, hearing this, takes out a knife and cuts off his arm and presents it to him. And Bodhidharma says, you have cut off your arm. Why? They were like that back then. We've gotten very soft. Right? If I cut off my arm, it would be hard for me to carry on a conversation. Bodhidharma says, why have you done this? And Weka says, my mind is not yet at ease. Please, Master, ease my mind. So, of course, the point of this is, and Suedo makes very clear, who would not carve an imitation? The point is not to imitate Weka. And yet, something is being presented. And so he invokes this, brings this forth in terms of a mud Buddha does not pass through water. So one question is, how is the mud Buddha, the wood Buddha, the gold Buddha, all passing through their own version of can't pass through this, water, fire, furnace? So how are they different? Are they different? Why does he present three different Buddhas in this way? And then why does Suedo, in a sense, give a teisho on each of these by presenting, as you'll see, a different story for each one? That's what's interesting about this. He draws from the tradition and brings a particular story for each of these. And each of them, the stories are different. Zhaozhou says, a gold Buddha can't pass through a furnace, wood Buddha can't pass through fire, mud Buddha can't pass through water. The true Buddha sits within you. And then he goes on to say, Bodhi, Nirvana, suchness, Buddha nature, these are just clothes stuck on the body. And as such are to be called compulsive passions. If you do not ask about them, they are not compulsive passions. Where can the true realm of reality be found? If you do not ask about them, if you do not get caught up in them. So all of these essential terms that we use in practice, he's saying are like clothes stuck to the body. They can cling to us, we can cling to them. Standing in the snow, if Weka didn't rest, if he didn't come to rest, so Bodhidharma says, bring that mind to me and I will set it at rest. And Weka went in search. He wanted nothing more than to locate that mind that had brought him to Bodhidharma, that he had spent years struggling with, his inner anguish, his inner dis-ease. So stark, so significant that as a gesture, he would cut off his arm in order to hear the teachings. Right? So what will we relinquish? How important is this? What are we willing to let go of? And so he searches and searches and comes to Bodhidharma and says, when I have searched for my mind, ultimately, I cannot find this mind. And Bodhidharma says, now I have put your mind at ease. So standing in the snow, if he didn't rest, if he hadn't come to ease, who would not carve an imitation? And so it brings up, in a sense, it's not the primary point of the koan, but it brings up that question of following an example, right? So here's a story that's cherished within the Zen tradition. It's told over and over and over again, right? So it's presented as being important for us, something for us to listen to reflect on, to be inspired by, to follow an example of. not by carving an imitation. And so, you know, following the example of is like a fundamental way of learning. I mean, every living thing is born into this world without knowing how to be in this world. And what do? They look around for some examples. What do I do, right? What are the skills that I need to learn? How do I walk? How do I fly? How do I get food, right? So every living thing follows examples. How does that become an imitation? When does following an example within Dharma practice? Here we are practicing together, close quarters, right? So we're experiencing in just countless moments, in countless ways through different senses, different people's practice. People who have been practicing for many, many years, people who are just starting to practice, people who are practicing in a particular moment, experiencing something, maybe a very deep state of meditation, maybe a very tumultuous inner world. We go through, it's very internal, it's very personal, in a way it's very private, and in a funny way, strange way, we go through this in a very public way, together. And so we're, within Sangha practice, we're continually being presented with examples. Some of them are very strong and powerful and, you know, you want to study, and other examples may be of how, what not to follow. You know, that when somebody does this, this is what happens. Oh, that's a good example of what not to do, of how not to follow. I mean, that just happens in life all the time. So following the example, particularly if we look up to someone, we respect them, we, you know, when I met my teacher and began studying, it was like, I wanted some of that, right? I didn't want to be him. Maybe in the beginning I kind of did, right? And that had to get clarified for me. He was never confused about that. But I needed to clarify that. And that was really important. But he was definitely an example. I mean, if we cannot find examples in almost anyone we encounter, I think we're not paying attention. That's why it's so wonderful that within a Sangha there are people who've been practicing for minutes and for decades. And that it's all tumbling together. Hueka, standing in the snow, was not alone. But he was in solitude. His teacher was not watching him. He seemed to be ignored. He did not waver. This is the example that's presented. Of course, we don't know what was happening in his mind. Did he have moments where he wavered, where he doubted, where he was angry, frustrated? It's reasonable. But what's presented is that he stood. He stayed in that place, just like we practice staying on this seat, even when we'd like to run away, fly away. How powerful is that? Showing ourselves that we can do that. And doing that well. Doing that freely. And finding our way towards doing that freely. You know, more than one person has told me other years that at certain moments, they would have gotten up and run out, but their ego wouldn't let them. They'd be embarrassed. They'd be ashamed. It's like, bravo to that ego. Right? It helped in that moment. It helped in a moment where I think, I can't do this, right? But my fear of embarrassment is greater, so I stay put, and what happens? I realize I can do this. I can do this. So Hueka's, and many examples showing if we are not stopped, deterred when we face difficulty, if we don't lose our faith in ourself, in the Dharma, when we don't get what we want, if we can see others stumbling and both have compassion and understanding and be able to relate to that, and if we can't, look harder, look closer, and remain steady ourselves. To follow an example, to be inspired by others, but not to make one's practice dependent on what is happening with another. If you can't do it, then I can't do it. Those who turn away when they don't get the attention they think they deserve, the recognition, the positions, the advancement, whatever. Vimalakirti said, if you come here for the sake of rewards, then you're not really coming for the sake of the Dharma. And that's why it's so important. And we stress the importance of understanding, oh, why are you here? Because, you know, you don't have to be. I mean, you could be like, you took this week off. You could be in vacationing somewhere. You could be having a great meal. You could be sleeping 24 hours a day. You could be, you're heaven. And so it's knowing, right? Yeah, that's all fine. That's good. But there's something actually more important. Hueka searched and searched for his mind and could not find it. What is the relationship between that and a mud Buddha does not pass through water? Zhaozhou said, the true Buddha sits within. So, of course, the question is, how do we meet this Buddha? How do we awaken to this mind? Since the beginning, the teachings have made it clear, you are in the midst of riches. You are swimming in a sea of tranquility. Throughout the day, that which you seek is never one hair's breadth apart. So why will the mud Buddha not pass through water? It's free. A mud Buddha is free. Why can't it pass through water? Because it's free. But what is that? Of course, the ordinary view is that the mud will get soft and dissolve, the nose will fall off, decompose, which is fine, you know, for an ordinary understanding, but it doesn't change anybody's life. Hueka's imperative was to locate his troubled mind. There was nothing that was more important than that. And so we sit to face this mind directly. The mud Buddha, the water passing through. It's all mind. So to meet the mud Buddha and know it thoroughly, to meet water and know it thoroughly, to meet passing through, to discover the reality of the Buddha itself and know water. So Zhaozhou could have just said, mud Buddha. Or he could have just said Buddha. Or he could have just said mud. Right? But it probably wouldn't have gotten into the collection. Discover the reality of Buddha and no water. Discover the nature of passing through and no Buddha. Our mind sees things as separate. There is this. There is that. There is this moving through that. There's starting here, there's ending there. And all of that has truth. The session has a beginning, we'll have an end. We kind of make a big deal about both, right? In fact, we kind of make a big deal about every beginning and ending, right? We celebrate with a signal, a drum, a bell, a clap. And then it's end. It ends. We begin a training period. We end a training period. We begin Ango. We end Ango. So there's truth to all of that. But if we want to find ease, we cannot live out of an imitation understanding of those truths, as though that's all there is, and impute into them a me and a you and a mine and a yours. And what does this have to do with today anyway? The mud Buddha can't pass through water. The water can't pass through mud Buddha. Neither the Buddha nor water can pass through passing through. What does that have to do with today? What is samsara anyway? Getting tangled. It's just getting tangled. I'm tangled with this. You're tangled with them. The self gets caught because there's a self. It gets caught. Because there is a self, it gets caught. Because we impute a self into everything, we have the potential to get caught in anything. All conditioned existence is dukkha. Walls, mountains, rivers, barriers, crises, all appear as something existing unto itself that is happening to me, to you, to others. There is a truth to that. We do not, we should not deny that. Seeing it only that way, it makes sense to tear it down, to build something else up, to climb over it, to cross over it, to overcome it, to manage it, to dominate it, to destroy it, to love it, to hate it. So what if we just bring it down to the basic thing? You sit, breathe. Where's the trouble? A body is not at ease. Pain comes and go. My breath is not relaxed. My awareness is dull. It's excited. I keep thinking about work. Problem with this relationship. I'm getting older. Summer's almost over. I'm going to die. If only there was a better, could only get a better job. I could just fix that relationship. If summer would go on forever, if I would never get old and die. Being enchanted means being enchanted with our dreams. You know, we think of kids living in a make-believe world. Kinda. And we're enchanted with it. And come on, a lot of it's pretty enchanting. But then there's all the, oh, it could be, or it should be. Or once I have this, then I'll get that. I mean, think about when that starts, when we're young, and we start seeing these mileposts, right? When I get to go to school, when I go to next school, when I go to next school, when I can drive, when I can drink, when I can date, when I can get out of the house. So let's bring it down to the basic thing. You sit, breathe, see. Where's the trouble? To ask is to presume, is to expect. Sit, breathe, see. Can you trust that?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.